Welcome to American Truth and Reality. My name is Ricky TNT. I want to thank you for listening in to our radio program today on BBS Radio. This program is a talk show that is a tell-it-like-you-see-it approach, and we cover an array of national and global and current events, including those most related to matters of faith, matters of politics, and even some sports coverage that have an impact on all of us as Americans and people throughout the world. Because as America goes, so goes the world. And the significant role that our country plays on the world stage with other nations and national and global events and what it means. And then we often make predictions and forecasts as to where we're headed as one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. So I want to welcome you to the program. We have a call-in number if you're interested in calling and speaking with me about any topic that you would like to bring up. You may hear some things on today's program or future or past programs that you agree with. You may hear some things that you adamantly disagree with. And we invite all opinions, regardless of whether you agree or disagree. We like to hear straight talk from the American people and get different perspectives, because truly, that is what this nation was founded on. And we welcome it. So the call-in number for today's radio program is 1-888-815-9756. Once again, 888-815-9756. So we review this week and we review what is in the news. And we have been inundated by what I consider to be the two main stories. One entirely important, and one, in my opinion, less than important in terms of national media and exposure. We heard all week long about the Democrats and the Republicans trying to get together to come to a national debt ceiling, or raising the national debt ceiling. And we've heard about President Obama and members of the Republican coalition meeting at the White House and heated exchanges, and President Obama storming out of the room saying he's going to take his case to the American people and that the Republicans are being irresponsible. And of course, on the Republican side, what we hear is that the president is insisting on tax cuts, and tax cuts for our nation at this particular time with a very, very bad economy, upwards of over 9% unemployment, that the timing could not be worse for tax increases onto the American people of any kind. Or as the government would like to refer to it as, revenue increases. Now, what's the difference between a revenue increase and a tax increase? Absolutely nothing. They're one and the same. So when we hear our politicians and our elected officials rewording things to try to repackage it and attempt to sell something in a light that is less than straightforward, we know something is missing, and it's usually the truth or the reality of the situation. But in any case, the argument comes down to, what do we do about the national debt, raising the national debt ceiling? Well, there's a couple things that come to mind. First of all, do we want to default on our credit rating? No, probably not. But what's uncertain is what happens if we do, for the first time, I think, in 75 years, if they don't raise the debt ceiling, which essentially, as everybody should know by now, is just authorize the Congress authorizing the United States government to increase their line of credit, even though we're in historically high debt, in a high deficit, well into the trillions of dollars. Some estimates are upwards of, we owe as a nation $14.5 trillion. That would be trillion with a T. $14.5 trillion. And we have to pay that back. China owns much of that debt. Just like a banker provides you a line of credit and you're expected to pay it back, well, China has been buying our bonds and our government securities, and they own about $3 trillion of that debt. Which always raises the question to me is this an investment? Is China investing in the United States of America as an investment opportunity because they believe in America? Or are there geopolitics involved and some type of manipulation of our markets by foreign governments, to include the Chinese? That opens the door to the trade agreements we have with China, the tariff situation being one-sided with China, and the whole Chinese and American relations as it relates to the flow of goods and services between the two countries. And we often hear in the news China has very much of a closed-door policy of letting the U.S. products in, but boy, they really flood our markets and our shores with their products and have bought our debt. So it's just something to keep in the back of our mind for this discussion. But in essence, the trillions of dollars, this nation is already in debt, and our annual deficit, meaning the amount of money the country takes in versus the amount of money that it spends, is at an all-time high, and there's no end in sight. So the Republicans' position is look, we have to stop borrowing. We have to stop borrowing and mortgaging our future. It's easy with a stroke of a pen to raise our credit line, but eventually we have to start paying that money back. So they're taking a position of, okay, we recognize that we need to raise our credit line. We need to raise our national borrowing limit in order not to default on our currency, because a default in our currency would lower the value of the dollar, which would likely spur inflation. So you go out and buy a gallon of milk, it's no longer $3 a gallon, it's $5 a gallon. A gallon of gas goes from, you know, $4 or $3.50 to $7. Depending, it's arguable as to what impact a already beaten up and battered U.S. dollar would take if we were to default or lose our AAA credit rating, which has been in place for 75 years, according to the Wall Street Journal, and we were downgraded. So that's one theory, that the U.S. dollar would be battered because we would lose our credibility in terms of paying our debt. But the Republicans are adamant that any type of raise in the credit limit and the borrowing limit of the United States of America must be offset by spending decreases. In other words, we have to make cuts in things that we can no longer afford as a nation. Now, what do you cut? Well, therein lies the problem. The problem that nobody seems to be able to agree on what to cut is a problem that has plagued our political system since its inception, and it's called special interests. And these are people that lobby Congress, they lobby the White House, they lobby anybody that they can. They're in positions of power and influence, and are elected officials that can help them move their agenda forward. Pardon me. Whatever that agenda may be. For example, the Republicans talk about military. and how important it is to keep a strong military, and we really shouldn't cut that, especially when we've got two wars going on, and now the action in Libya, and a strong national defense is paramount, always has been, for the United States, which, you know, makes a lot of sense. Not to mean that there isn't some government waste and in the military and efficiencies and other things, but their point is that's really untouchable. Of course, the flip side of that is the Obama administration and the Democratic Party says that we can't touch entitlements. We can't change Medicare. We can't change Social Security and other programs. The bottom line is something has to give. And the bottom line is something's going to have to give on both sides, because there's one of two things that are going to happen. Either we default and we accept the consequences of a default and the devaluing of the U.S. dollar, which I don't think would necessarily be helpful in a bad economy. But at the same time, we can't continue to kick the can down the road in the way of spending cuts. So, what to do? You have a very powerful group of people that are influencing these decision makers. Call them lobbyists. Call them supporters. These are the people that finance elections, that finance re-elections, and can sometimes skew our elected officials' point of view from doing what's best and doing the right thing or the difficult thing versus doing what's in their political self-preservation agenda. I don't know what's going to happen, like nobody does, with this debt crisis and this raising the national debt, but I do know this. I do know that the American people are as fed up as they have ever been by the political process and the inability to get anything done in Washington, D.C. that does not further the interests of our nation. And I do know that we have this tremendous amount of debt that we're straddled with, that our children are straddled with, our grandchildren, and maybe several more generations down the road, should it continue. We are in this position because Ronald Reagan was right. And some of you may remember Ronald Reagan. Some of you may not remember Ronald Reagan. But Ronald Reagan was famous for a few lines, and one of those lines that Ronald Reagan was famous for was, "Government is too big and it spends too much." Now, all the partisan politics aside, all of the back and forth and one wearing a Democrat hat and another one wearing a Republican hat or whatever political hat any of us wear, let's take that hat off and let's put on our American people hat. Certainly, pragmatically, we can understand that in a very high debt situation, we have to reduce our expenditures, which means we have to reduce the size of our government. The government is too big, and the government spends too much. And nowhere in our Constitution or anywhere will you find in our founding documents that government was ever supposed to become this almost unmanageable entity. Now, I'm not anti-government. I certainly need government. We need government. There's no question about it. We need police. You know, we need fire. We need local officials to represent us. We need state officials. We need national officials. But, and the government does do a lot of good things, I believe, for people in certain areas. But clearly, the government doesn't do everything well. And the government doesn't spend the taxpayers' money well. Taxpayers meaning you and me, the American people, wearing our American people hat. So it seems to me that a very pragmatic, simple approach is to reduce the size of government at all levels, with defense cuts being the least priority, and the government bureaucracies and departments that are overstaffed, that are expensive to maintain, and that have demonstrated very little value to our day-to-day way of life, and have demonstrated, frankly, that if they were eliminated, those departments, it wouldn't impact anybody's day-to-day life. And when I say anybody, I would say that it would impact very, very few people's day-to-day lives. But what you have is you have the protection of sacred cows. You have the protection of, we can't cut this, we can't cut that. We have to keep everything that we have now, even though we can't afford it. We have to keep everything in place. And what we need to do is we need to tax the American people. We need to say, look, in order for us to maintain all these great government programs and all of these, this great mammoth, massive bureaucracy, we need more money. So we need to take it out of your pocket and out of your paycheck and out of your blood, sweat, and tears in order to pay for big government. I don't think on this one, I don't think that the prevailing wisdom of the American people will be, we need to maintain the current size and scope and span of our federal government. I really do believe that the American people are ready, as demonstrated in the 2010 elections we had just this past November. The American people are ready to reduce the size of government, and they sent the Republicans in to do it because they didn't view President Obama with the healthcare program and the healthcare plan as somebody that would be capable of leading us to a smaller government. We went too big too fast and added another entitlement program when our economy and our financial system was in shambles, and our healthcare system, although not perfect, was adequate enough for us to refocus our energies and our leaders refocus themselves on the priorities of this country, which was jobs and getting this economy going and getting that unemployment rate down. What we've seen is a $1 trillion stimulus plan, more spending, very, very few, if any, cuts, more debt, and now the administration is coming and saying, we need more money. And, well, we don't have it in the coffers, so we need just to borrow more money. Maybe borrow it from the Chinese or whoever will buy our debt. I don't see that approach as being in the best interests of our country if we're wearing our American people hat. I would much rather see a plan that reduces the size of government in every department by 10 to 15% with military and defense being a significantly less percentage of that because of the fact that we have two wars going on and we need to defend ourselves against nations or groups or terrorists that would otherwise attack us. The question is are they going to make a deal? We hear all of the drama. We remember no drama Obama, which apparently is no longer the case. We hear all of the back and forth between the Republicans and Democrats as to we want this, they want that. But at the end of the line, if we don't have a reduction in the scope and the span of this massive United States government, and we're talking about This is a massive sized government that you and I are paying for, the American people. And if we don't have reductions and we just continue to add to the debt, then the thing that they're trying to avoid is ultimately going to happen anyway. They're trying to avoid a devalued dollar or to head off inflation. And, you know, the stimulus didn't work. The jobs package didn't work. The TARP and financial salvation of some of our banks, some would argue it worked. Others would argue it was a temporary fix and a short-term fix and not a long-term fix. The bottom line is that something has to give here. And you have two groups, two camps, if you will, between Republicans and Democrats that says, one says, how do we maintain, or how do we increase our credit line? One group says we tax wherever and however we can. And they use the cute word revenue, generating revenue. That's government revenue, otherwise known as a tax on the people. And then you have another camp that says we actually should be reducing taxes and have America reopen for business and reinvesting our resources in America so that we can be prosperous again and people can get back to work. And then after time and making the appropriate cuts and budgeting our nation's future, we can pay down our debt. That's where the rub is. That is where our elected officials cannot come to an agreement. So my question is where do the American people fall down on this? We're the ultimate decision makers. We're the ultimate individuals that decide who becomes our representative in Congress, in the Senate, and ultimately our president. Where does the nation stand in terms of the issue of raising our debt and keeping the size and the scope of the federal government intact or reducing it? And I really think that this next election is going to be all about that. What both these parties don't want to do, the Democrats and the Republicans, is they don't want to be the one blamed for the blowback or the consequences of having made the wrong decisions or the wrong choices, whether that's a default on our credit rating or a default on our debt or a reduction in the cost, in the value of the U.S. dollar. And, of course, we're heading into a presidential election, and the candidates all know very clearly that they need money. And the way that you get money is you promise the special interests that have given you money before that you will continue to represent their special interests and you won't give in, and they can count on you so that they will make a donation to your campaign and you'll have the fuel for your engine to operate your campaign machine and go on to potentially be reelected. It's going to be extremely interesting season. I predict that it's going to be a very divisive and a nasty presidential campaign and other races in the Congress. And this will be, I believe, this election, 2012, will be a turning point in our nation's history. And it will determine what happens to our country 5, 10, 15 years down the line and what type of country that we pass on to the next generation. My guess, and I have really no basis for this other than just pure speculation and conjecture. It's kind of a gut feeling. My guess is the American people are going to recognize that the government is too large, it needs to be reduced, and they're going to support candidates that are for a smaller government and to rein in our national debt and our annual deficit that we run as a nation. That's my guess. Because to view this situation otherwise would simply be equivalent to an ostrich putting his head in the sand, pretending that what's going on doesn't exist and things can just go on their merry way. We can just continue to increase our credit line and increase our debt, and then finally, we will be bankrupt. And, you know, some argue right now that we are bankrupt as a nation. I mean, the reality is we owe more money than we have. We owe more money than the government takes in, not because the American people are taxed too much or too little. See, that's the fallacy. That's the lie. The lie is, you know, the American people need to be taxed more so that we can afford to feed this monster, this beast of monster government, and need to be taxed more so we can keep this big monster going. No, that is not the solution. The solution is the American people should be taxed less, or not increase taxes at least, and the size of government that does not impact the American people's day-to-day lives. I'm talking about the majority of the people. Yeah, one program here, another program there might impact this group or that group, but we have to look at things as a nation. And we've always taken care of the less fortunate in this country. The poor people in this country are rich compared to the poor people in Sudan and in Zimbabwe or Africa and other parts of this world in Asia. If you took a poor person from another part of this world and put them in our country to live with our poor, they would think that they were living a pretty good life. And that's just the truth of the matter. I'm not discrediting or suggesting that our poor people in any way aren't suffering or going through hardships. Certainly that they are. But what I am saying is, at the end of the day, what do we need? We need food, water, shelter, and unconditional love to live happy lives. And some of our poor people have those things, others don't. But on a comparative level, our poor people are not suffering anywhere near the degree of many of the poor people overseas in the areas I mentioned in other parts of the world, even in South America, in Brazil and Paraguay and countries like that. So the question comes down to, are the American people going to support a reduction in government to reduce government expenditures, or are they going to support someone that says, let's keep the government the same size and let's tax everybody more because we need more revenue so we can afford to maintain our current size of government? I'm going to bet that the American people will make a wise decision and will definitely decide our future by rendering their verdict as to where they fall down on that question. And I believe that they're going to decide that the government is too big and it spends too much and it needs to be reduced, and our expenditures and programs that don't work and have no tangible benefit to the day-to-day lives of the majority of the Americans in this country need to be eliminated or reworked or reinvented. We'll see. We'll see. It's going to be very interesting. The other main story this week was Casey Anthony. And I'm not going to comment so much on the case. I followed it here and there, not in any detail, only because I couldn't avoid it. And you turn on a TV, and it doesn't matter if you watch Fox News or CNN or MSNBC, every station is running the trial live. And Casey Anthony and the Casey Anthony trial and her last days in jail. And I just find it highly unusual. I find it weird, actually. I find it weird that our media obsesses, as a national media, television media, not so much radio talk shows. Some do, some don't. But our national television media just obsesses over a story that really could be reported because, you know, it might be of interest to people, a mother potentially, you know, murdering her own child. Of course, that's shocking. It's very disturbing. And what went wrong? And people have a curiosity, or at least an idle curiosity, to what's going on. But to spend the amount of time, focus, energy that our national media has spent on this story is just weird. It's weird. Because this isn't the first story of its kind. You know, we've had parents, you know, cause harm on their children, even into death over the decades and throughout the world. And Kathy Anthony isn't the only suspected, whether she did it or not. You know, I don't know that we'll ever know the truth of that. But we certainly don't have the truth in that case. But, you know, there's a lot of parents throughout the world that might be suspected of harming their children to the degree that Kathy Anthony was suspected. But why the time and the focus and the energy? I mean, hour after hour, day after day. I mean, you can't tell me that there aren't more pressing and important problems and issues facing our nation, facing our world today, than what's going on in one case down in Florida with a girl named Kathy Anthony and what she did or didn't do in terms of a criminal act. I find it very weird that our national media spends this kind of time on this kind of story. I want to remind you that if you'd like to call in and speak about any issue, it could be politics, faith, you want to talk about sports, please call 1-888-815-9756. Once again, 888-815-9756. Want to move on to a little bit of sports, actually. The NFL and the Players Association, or the NFL owners and the Players Association, are trying to finalize a deal so there's no disruption in the season. I do want to reiterate a prediction I made. I think it was back on June 11th with my guest host, Bob Brown. And incidentally, Bob is on vacation today, so I got the radio program all to myself. I actually kind of like it. It's kind of nice having the program all to myself. Anyway, Bob will be back on our next show 2 weeks from today. But on June 11th, I predicted that before July 26th, the NFL Players Associations and the NFL owners would finalize a deal. Now, if you go back into the papers, if you look back at the publications around June 11th, June 10th, in the news media, there was no indication that there was any deal close. In fact, both sides were dug in. It looks like we're far apart. The season could be in jeopardy. What a shame. And both sides were dug in. The owners locked out the players. So I made a prediction that before July 26th, they would ink an agreement. They would make a deal. And if the season was going to be interrupted, it would be, you know, one preseason game or two, which I think is probably going to be part of the new collective bargaining agreement. Well, in the last 2 weeks, we've seen some very favorable media reports in terms of coming together and reaching an agreement. And I stick with my original prediction that I made back on June 11th, that on or around July 26th, a final agreement will be made. Now, why did I do that? Or why did I make that prediction? Simple. There was too much money, and there is way, way too much money involved for the owners and the players. I mean, you're talking about a $9 billion industry. And if there's no season, the owners don't make their revenue and fill up their brand new stadiums. And the players don't make their millions or tens of millions of dollars in their contracts. So both sides stood to lose. And then the ultimate loss would be losing the faith and the fan base of the NFL, because nobody would be more angered or irritated than the American National Football League fan, because this country loves its football. This country loves its NFL. This country loves its teams. Doesn't matter, you know, if you're a Green Bay Packer fan like me, or should I say the world champion Green Bay Packers? Yes, that's right. Or, you know, Steelers fan, or an Eagles fan, or a 49ers fan, or a Jets fan, or whatever. The point is that people love their football in this country. And there would be such a backlash if the regular season was interrupted or somehow tainted by not having a full season. So common sense told me two things. Number one, it would be kind of an easy one, that so much money's on the table, the players and owners will lose so much money that they're not going to be willing to take that risk to not play a season and lose all that money. And number two, they're not willing to take the risk with the fans having a tainted season, like a 12-game season, or, you know, not the regular season, because whoever would win the Super Bowl would be kind of be viewed as illegitimate because it was a 12-game season instead of a 16-game season. So that was my basis. We are now exactly 10 days away from July 26th. The deal could come as soon as this week. I still stick with on or before or around July 26th is my prediction. I have no inside sources. I have no information other than what you read, and whether it's the Wall Street Journal or the local paper, or you hear from media reports. It's just a prediction. So stay tuned, and we'll know soon enough whether that prediction comes to fruition. But I will say, if they don't come to an agreement, and again, I do believe they will, but if they don't, there will be a very, very angry American public, angry at the NFL, and that will hit them directly where they don't want to be hit, and that is right in the wallet and right in the checkbook, in the pocketbook. So I think it was inevitable all along, and what we get in media reports is a lot of posturing, and same with our political system, you know, all this posturing, and we need this, and we need that, you know, and then finally, you know, they can make a deal. Now, there should be no reason. If the NFL owners and Players Association can make a deal, so can the United States government and the Republicans and Democrats do the necessary give and take to fix our financial situation, our economic situation, and put our financial house in order. No reason whatsoever. I want to move on to a program that we had 2 weeks ago. I had mentioned, it was a pre-recorded program because I was on vacation 2 weeks ago, and gave the BBS producer, Don, the recorded version from the June 11th show that he replayed on our last program. And we actually ran an hour and 20 minutes, so the last 20 minutes got cut off. But I happened to be listening to the very end of the pre-recorded program, and it was cut off right when I was making a recommendation for a book. And I want to come back and make that recommendation here in a minute before the end of today's program. What I'd like to do next is share with you a reading that is going to be said, and I should say a reading that's going to be read tomorrow and today throughout the entire world and throughout the entire globe, and the universal and the universality of the Roman Catholic Church. All the churches will read from this reading, this gospel reading, tomorrow, and I wanted to share it with you, and then I wanted to kind of break it down and try to determine what is our Lord trying to tell us. Now, the reason for a gospel is the Lord speaking to all of humanity for all of time. His words are endless. His parables can be applied today equally and as powerfully as they could be interpreted 2,000 years ago. I don't buy into the notion that, that was 2,000 years ago. Times are different now. Things are different. People and human nature and the universal battle between good and evil is alive and well today. And I would argue potentially even more so than it was 2,000 years ago. So our Lord Jesus is our master, and his words are perpetual and endless and apply today and always. And they're meant for us to give us direction, to hear his voice, to follow the good shepherd, because what's at stake is our eternal souls and our destiny. And we're either destined for eternal happiness in the kingdom of heaven with him, or we are destined for eternal punishment. Yeah, that for me, that's a very simple choice. I'd much rather be in a good place. And I hope most of the listeners here would too, but we do have those that oftentimes can misunderstand the purpose of their life and the purpose of being here in the first place and what's it about. But by anybody's measure, clearly this life is temporary. This life here on earth for all of us is temporary. But yet we have an eternal soul, and what we do here carries forward for better or for worse into eternity. And that's why this life is so important, and it was important enough for our Lord to come and be called by Almighty God the Father and begotten, if you will, to come and be the Good Shepherd and to lead us to the kingdom. As nobody comes to the Father, as Jesus himself said, nobody comes to the Father except through me. Now, either you believe that and accept that, which isn't hard to do. It's not hard to believe that and accept that. If you look at and analyze the Lord's life, and the best way to do that, in my opinion, is just to read the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Most of us have a Bible in our home. Pick up the Bible, go to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and see what the Lord is telling you as an individual and what he's trying to tell all of us as part of the human family on the way to save our soul. And it's very, very enlightening, and it's very fulfilling, and it's prayerful and it's holy to read the Gospels, because you're reading the word of the Lord, his words for us, meant for us and designed for us. So, this Sunday, the reading comes from, and I'm gonna read the gospel, and then I'm gonna go through some commentary and break it down a little bit, because this is a week and a reading that the Lord speaks in parables. And some people that don't spend a lot of time reading the gospels or trying to absorb them have difficulty maybe interpreting what those parables and parables mean. So I'm gonna do my best to give you my take on what the parables mean. But this Sunday will be a reading from the Holy Gospel according to Matthew. Glory to you, O Lord. Jesus proposed another parable to the crowds, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be likened to a man who sowed good seed in his field. While everyone was asleep, his enemy came and sowed weeds all through the wheat and then went off. When the crop grew and bore fruit, the weeds appeared as well. The slaves of the householder came to him and said, "Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where have the weeds come from?" He answered, "An enemy has done this." The slave said to him, "Do you want us to go and pull them up?" And Jesus replied, "No. If you pull up the weeds, you might uproot the wheat along with them. Let them grow together until harvest. Then at harvest time, I will say to the harvesters, 'First collect the weeds and tie them in bundles for burning. But gather the wheat into my barn.'" He proposed another parable to them. "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that a person took and sowed in a field. It is the smallest of all seeds, yet when full grown, it is the largest of plants. It becomes a large bush, and the birds of the sky come and dwell in its branches." And he spoke to them another parable. "The kingdom of heaven is like yeast that a woman took and mixed with 3 measures of wheat flour until the whole batch was leavened." All these things Jesus spoke to the crowd in parables. He spoke to them only in parables to fulfill what he had said through the prophets. "I will open my mouth in parables. I will announce what has lain hidden from the foundation of the world." The Holy Gospel according to St. Matthew. Glory to you, O Lord. Okay, so the Lord gives us 3 parables in this week's Gospel. Why did he give us parables? Well, that was answered at the very end of today's Gospel reading, this Sunday's Gospel reading, and that is he, to fulfill what he has spoken through the prophets, that he will speak in parables and so that he will announce what is laid hidden from the foundation of the world, from the very beginning of this world, and you know, the beginning of humankind on this world, this is laid hidden. And he's speaking as the Word of God and the Son of God to open up and show what is hidden by speaking in parables, as was made known by the prophets before his birth. So, these 3 parables, like that, you know, in last Sunday's Gospel, you may or may not have been paying attention to last Sunday's Gospel, but Jesus explains why he teaches in parables. And in the final section, he explains the parables of the weeds and the wheat. Now, naturally concerned about keeping the field fruitful, the slaves that were asking to perform a practical gardening choice of removing the weeds. Yet our Master Jesus later reveals himself as the Son of Man. He teaches them that the weeds and the wheat are to grow together until the harvest. At the time of harvest, that is the time of our last judgment. And the weeds will face, the weeds, the bad, the evildoers, the evil people. The weeds will face the consequence and the consequences of the evil that they perpetuated. And they will burn in a fiery furnace. On the other hand, the wheat, which is a symbol of those who have remained faithful, despite the temptation of the evil weeds, will remain forever in the kingdom of heaven. The point about the kingdom in this parable, then, is that until the time of final judgment, wheat and weeds, and good and evil, faithful ones and unfaithful ones, will coexist. Now, we look around our world today, clearly, good and evil coexist. Now, in the second parable, Jesus shows how the kingdom of heaven grows exponentially by using the symbol of a mustard seed. And The mustard seed, incidentally, is only about 2 millimeters in diameter, and it's a very tiny seed that grows to be a small tree in the area of the Holy Land, in the area of Israel. And as the tree looks inviting to the birds of the sky who come to make their home in it, so too the kingdom of heaven is welcoming, opening itself universally to those who choose to believe. For those who choose to believe. And in the third parable, the woman mixes the yeast with flour, and the leavening action of the yeast causes the entire batch to rise. Now, in the Jewish tradition, leaven denoted the propensity of human persons to sin. Yet in this parable, the leavening against the leveling agent symbolizes God's power. So the leavening is a symbol of God's power. And this parable then shows us that because of this merciful power, the kingdom will grow. Even though evil exists and there was weeds all around us, the good will prevail, the good will grow, the kingdom will grow, and the weeds on Judgment Day will be gathered and put in the fiery furnace. And we, if we are good and reject evil, will be in the kingdom of heaven. So, the explanation of the parable of the wheat and the weeds ends with a command for those who have ears to hear. For those who have ears to hear. You may hear, but do you listen? Do we listen faithfully? I guess we all can ask ourselves that question, including yours truly. Last week I recommended a book right along these lines, and I want to share that recommendation with you. It's a book by Father Michael Scanlon, and it's a book called Deliverance from Evil Spirits. Now, kind of a shocking title to a book, right? Deliverance from Evil Spirits. Well, I think at a gut level, at a soul level, just about every human being that I meet that isn't a crazy loon or a wacko in one way or the other understands that there are good forces and there are evil forces in our world that surround us. We can't see them because call them spirits or call them energy, call them what you will. But we can't see them with the naked eye. But we know that they exist. Christ himself, when he exercised demons out of people with dozens of witnesses and written accounts, people saw these things. They saw Jesus perform these acts, driving demons and evil spirits out of people, and they wrote them down. And that's what we have in the way of evidence. Just like our court of law, and we have eyewitness testimony, and it's a very powerful, probably the most powerful piece of evidence, eyewitness testimony in our court of law. Well, 2,000 years ago, it was no different. We have dozens and dozens of people, not the least of which were the 12 apostles, the 11, you know, plus Judas, who betrayed Jesus, writing down their accounts of what they saw. And what they saw was Christ driving demons out of people. But what they also saw, and I want to leave you with this thought, is they saw the power of the Master and the Lord Jesus Christ on display. And clearly, any evil entity was scared blankless, for lack of a better term. They were scared of the Lord because they know who is the Lord and God of the universe. They knew that he was the Son of Man. And, you know, in one gospel story, you'll remember Jesus, they said, throw us, you know, if you take us out of these people and throw us into the swine, and which he did, but then all the swine went over the cliff and all the farmers were mad at Jesus because he threw the demons into the swine and the farmers lost all their swine, which is their way to make a living. And there's probably a reason for that. But they were clearly running scared. They knew he was the Son of God and that he is all-powerful. And this book empowers all of us. Deliverance from Evil Spirits by Michael Scanlon. It's a great book, very easy to read, just over 100 pages. And wrapping up here on today's show, I would recommend strongly that if you want to learn about the things that you cannot see with your eye, but you can feel them and sense them and be empowered to defeat any darkness and any evil influences or temptation that you may be faced with, I strongly recommend this book, Father Michael Scanlon, Deliverance from Evil Spirits. I want to thank you for listening to this program. I look forward to our next program 2 weeks from now. I wish all of you all the best, and may God bless you, all of your family, all of your loved ones, all of your friends, and everyone that you carry around in your heart. God bless you all. Thank you, and have a great weekend, everybody.